that the delivered price of Prudhoe Bay gas can in fact be rolled in, which is one, the only category of gas that was given that particular right. But if the pipeline is completed by 19, what do I dare say? I won't put it past 1986 for fear of being quoted as an abominable pessimist. I wouldn't dare be saying anything earlier than 1896 for fear of being scorned as an abominable optimist. But if we take 1986 as sort of a pivotal figure now, you've got to ask yourself, well, what kind of gas is going to be rolled in with that? Because the longer you go, the greater the decline in the available flow of old gas, which may be or may not be under price control at that time. Now, the lower the price and the greater the volume, the greater the effect of roll-in, and the better your chances you have of absorbing the high-cost Prudhoe Bay gas when it's delivered. But there are going to be changes in law. Now, this I'm absolutely convinced. I don't know what particular changes, but the Natural Gas Policy Act of 1978 is not going to be on the books in 1984 or even 1983. Within a year, there are going to have to be revisions. And if those revisions take the form of lifting price controls on various categories of gas, including phasing out some of the old gas and letting it get a market price by 1985, 1986, 1987, then you've got a problem in rolling. And as a matter of fact, it may very well be that by 1986, 1987, at least in the early years of production and delivery of Prudhoe Bay gas, it's going to have to stand on its own feet with very little economic support from rolling. And I'd be very concerned about that.
I just wanted to follow up on the one question, then I'll let the other members have it. Did I understand you to say that if the state of Alaska and the federal government, one of the two, do not get involved, guaranteeing getting involved in financing of the pipeline, that the chances of it being built are greatly diminished?
Oh, yes. I give it to you as an uninformed opinion, but I think you've had this from many more informed people, that it looks very, very unlikely that given this level of costs and the risks still associated, that the total package of financing can be put together without the state of Alaska or the federal government being parties to the ultimate bearing and sharing of the risk.
But it just seems to me that the statements I've heard and the commitments, those two things, that those are the two important factors that we could resolve this matter. The federal government says they're not putting any money in it, the last I've heard. And the state of Alaska has never had any indication or shown any strong indication that they intended to put money into that. That just strengthens the position maybe we ought to have an alternative.
Senator, excuse me for interrupting, but in my mind, there are never any absolutes. There is never a never. Change the circumstances, and who knows whether or not the federal government, out of a sense of responsibility to its treaty commitment to Canada, we're very badly out on the limb on that, with the Trudeau government having exposed itself to incredible political risks within Canada, for having decided to go ahead with the pre-built on the basis of a smile and nod from the United States government without a firm commitment of support. This is a political problem. In the end, it may be that the federal government, for a combination of reasons, it's indigenous energy, it contributes to the energy security of the nation, we have a treaty commitment. There may be various forms, and indeed, it may even be possible to get a measure of federal support without even changing the law. That is to say, if the commitments or the guarantees are not to the pipeline, but are, say, to either lenders or consumers who bear the ultimate risk, there are possibilities, so I wouldn't foreclose them all.
Mr. Chairman, Dr. Lipp, what is the difference in the role of the producers on the North Slope as owners of the oil vis-a-vis owners of the gas? Now, you've mentioned some things about the difficulties, perhaps, from the producer's point of coming in with because of equity limitations and of various pricing factors and so on, but is it to their interest, really, to utilize that gas? What factors weigh most heavily, do you think, in their decision?
Well, I think there's no question whatsoever but that all of the producers have a very fundamental interest in seeing that the Prudhoe Bay gas is produced, both the associated gas and, in due course, the gas cap gas, is produced and generates revenues over and above costs as against the alternative of continuing reinjection with the costs involved in reinjection and with the adverse impact that this may ultimately have upon the oil recovery. But for this, I think the record, I think an awful lot of data is available. Technical data is on the record. From an economic standpoint, I have no doubt whatsoever that all of the owners of Prudhoe Bay Gas would like to see a plan, a decision moving ahead, which permits them to produce the gas and one way or another to generate revenues from the production of the gas.
So it's complicated enough it has to take the wellhead, their recovery price, along with costs of interjection and just what they do with the stuff.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Well, reinjection is nothing. Reinjection is a clear cost to them, nothing but a cost. In effect, what it does is diminish the value of the oil they produce if they have costs of natural gas reinjection endlessly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've been rather intrigued in the last few months to read the newspaper accounts about the Northwest Gas Line, and consistently they state that everything is moving ahead. The only problem is with the financing. And I keep thinking, they're not going to move anywhere until we really deal with that question. And when you cut through it all, it seems to me like the real question is, when the original decision was made to go with Northwest, it was predicated on federal financing. And, that's my interpretation. Now, it looks to me like that's a big obstacle at this point. Now, you've just said there's a possibility we may have federal financing. But if we don't, we're essentially saying, does the state have to step in and assume that role that the federal government was going to make if we're to progress with this line?
Senator Stimson, let me just refresh your mind on this. Pursuant to congressional statute, when the presidential office made the selection as among competing proposals, every proposal, excepting only the Northwest alternative, stipulated that some kind of governmental financing would be necessary to complete their particular transportation. It was Northwest alone that stipulated it could be financed entirely by the private commitment of capital, and that at least must have been one consideration that bore upon the decision to select the Alaska Northwest project as an alternative to the Arctic Gas Consortium or the El Paso proposal.
Okay. You're absolutely right. I reversed that. I was recalling how critical the federal role was in that, and the important part of that was that they were going to stay completely out of it. The question, of course, that's been in my mind this entire time is, then who takes the initial step in all of this? And obviously, I think the producers have been waiting for the state to do that. And the state is waiting to see whether that's going to be an investment that they want to participate in the first place. And the whole time, and thank you, I did confuse that. The whole time, the federal government has been attempting to stay out of it. And it seems to me like that's the essence of the question. Can we progress with this line without federal government participation? And from what I've seen, it isn't very feasible.
Well, as I said, there's a catch-22 quality about this whole thing. So long as the participants in the Alaska Northwest Project are trying to put together a privately financed package of capital, to talk about public participation, say federal or state participation, too much induces every possible private participant to say, hey, let's not go too fast on this. Let's hold back and see what we can get in terms of government support, like loan guarantees and so on. So that if you're trying to put together a privately financed package, there's a reluctance to talk too much about governmental support. On the other hand, if at the end of the day you are unable to put together a privately financed package and you've explored all alternatives, then willy-nilly either you abandon the project or you go to the various governments concerned and you say, let's participate. In Canada, I think the same problem exists in Canada. The bulk of the Canadian line from the Alaskan border down into Alberta will probably require a considerable amount of governmental support there. But that's less of a problem in Canada because natural gas pipeline construction in Canada has a whole long history of governmental support. As a matter of fact, the Alberta Gas Trunk Natural Gas Corporation, which now is a major participant in the in the foothills section of the Alaska Highway Natural Gas Pipeline, was originally a crown corporation of the province of Alberta. and was originally financed entirely by the province of Alberta, and has since it's gone to private ownership and has a great deal of provincial support. And TransCanada Natural Gas Pipeline, which links Alberta gas with Eastern Canada and with the United States, essentially had a tremendous amount of Canadian federal government support. So that in Canada, it's a somewhat different problem with an entirely different governmental precursor to the problem.
One of the proposal of private financing for Northwest Gas Pipeline was probably one of the important factors in them being selected. Now, if we're in a situation where the option is only government aid, then does that again bring back an all-Alaska line as an option?
Well, that's difficult to say. The decision may be made by the federal government because of what they feel are strong political commitments, that if the Alaska Natural Gas Pipeline cannot be built without federal support, then we have to give them federal support. And they may not consider alternatives because there is a political commitment. I don't prejudge how Congress and the administration would act on that. I feel that from the standpoint of Alaska, that whether or not you provide financial support should be contingent not only on the dire straits of that particular natural gas pipeline, but what you consider to be viable alternatives. Now, it may be a natural gas pipeline through Alaska with the transportation of liquefied natural gas thereafter, which is sort of an El Paso thing. That still faces the same problem, the high cost of natural gas transportation through Alaska. It's either 800 miles from Prudhoe to the Canadian border, or it's 800 miles from Prudhoe down to Tidewater. And I'm not being negative about it. It has a lot of the same thing, but I think the methanol alternative is something you ought to be looking at.
Let me ask one question, Doctor. If the state of Alaska decided to take a liquid line Tidewater, what would that do to the economics of the Northwest Pipeline by taking off our portion of the gas?
Well, it's not just your portion of the liquids, because you're not going to move just the royalty liquids. If you take out all of the liquids, you raise the cost of transportation of the methane through a natural gas pipeline. And it's a very substantial impact, because in effect you're diminishing the throughput. As a matter of fact, you're also reducing the average BTU content of what's delivered at the other end. So it will have an effect upon the unit cost of transportation in the natural gas pipeline as well. There have been cost estimates made on what that effect would be. It depends upon what proportion of the liquids are taken out and a lot of other things. But I should say one other thing which is of tremendous interest to Alaska, that every increase in the cost of transportation through a natural gas pipeline, as I said before, reduces the wellhead value. But when it reduces the wellhead value, it improves the economics of alternative use. And the higher the cost of moving a BTU of energy through the line, the greater the value of the molecule that you've got left for internal use in Alaska. That is to say that the rising costs of natural gas transportation improve the potential prospects of utilizing the natural gas liquids, not necessarily for their BTUs, but for their molecules. The late Shah of Iran was always fond of saying that oil is too precious to be used in its base uses. That is to say, the base BTUs against the precious molecules. He was all for petrochemical operations. That's an economic thing. But the point I wanted to make is that the rising costs do improve all of the economics for the internal transportation and use of the natural gas liquids.
Senator Duckworth.
What is the market for gas right now as far as supply and demand in the United States?
At the moment, it's in surplus.
It's what?
In surplus. I tell you, one quick illustration, that Canada has just approved the increased export of natural gas to the United States when this pre-built is finished, on the order of about 1 billion cubic feet a day, which is about a 30% increase in our authorized exports. At the present time, we are not taking all of the gas which has already been authorized. Now, partly it's because of the pricing of Canadian gas, but essentially, it's because we now have, temporarily, in the United States, a surplus of immediately available gas, that is the what's called the gas bubble, as compared to current consumption. But I would not think that's a factor to be concerned with for 1986 and onward.
Don't think so. I was wondering what's Mexican gas now, 247 or something, and it was...
They've been increased, yeah.
If we were to build an all-Alaska gas pipeline as we originally talked about under the El Paso projection, market's not there on the West Coast.
Well, if you remember, the El Paso representations always were that not necessarily, that you would not necessarily compete with alternative gas in California, but in a sense you would be using the regasified Prudhoe Bay gas on the West Coast, displacing other sources of gas which then would move into Midwest and Eastern U.S. markets. Now, I think if I were you, without regard to the pros and cons of the El Paso suggestion, I would always think of gas available to the United States from whatever source, whether it's Mexican gas at the Texas border, Canadian gas coming down the West Coast or into the Midwest, Alaskan gas, however it comes, imported liquefied natural gas from Algeria or from Indonesia. Always think of that as a net contribution to the total gas availability of the United States, which really doesn't have to be justified in the particular market closest to where it enters the United States. What you have then is a reshuffling of available gases, and the economics of competition will determine where the gas goes, and in effect, it's not an MCF of gas competing with an MCF of gas. It's 6 MCFs of gas competing with a barrel of fuel oil somewhere, which is imported.
Thank you very much, Doctor. We're going to have to cut it off. We have to get downstairs in just a few moments. Thank you. First item this morning is bill assignment. We have Senate Bill 54, an act relating to the Alaska National Guard and Naval Militia. Assign that to Senator Sackett. First item we'll take up this morning is committee substitute for Senate Bill number 4, Senator Sturgiolewski.
Mr. Chairman, is it necessary to make a motion on to bring a committee substitute before us? I'd like to consider that. I would move that we do consider committee substitute for Senate Bill number 4. Ask unanimous consent. Mr. Chairman, I think this, hopefully there's material enough in your packet to explain some details about this bill. We do have Barbara Walker from the Nurses Association here this morning. The bill basically requires the coverage of nurse midwives practice under health and disability insurance policies that pay for maternity care and adds it to the list of coverages for Medicaid. The committee substitute has two changes from the original bill. We had some questions that arose by the American Council of Life Insurance providers, Mike Thomas represented them, regarding when would this coverage become effective under outstanding insurance policies. So sections 1 and the very final section of the bill, Section 27, reflect discussions that were held between myself, Mr. Thomas, and Don Koch of the Division of Insurance, and what they speak to are the issue of when the coverage would become available through the various policies. And there's agreement on the part of the administration as well as the industry that that's an appropriate way to implement this bill. I won't go into a lot of detail. I would be happy to respond to any specific questions that you have. There seem to be good support for the bill. We've indicated that in some of the material that you have attached. There was some concern on the part of particularly the Fairbanks medical community. I think those relate generally to a professional issue I think that's been before the legislature before as to the relationship among some of the parts of the profession, say the OB, GNs, and the general practitioners. I do think in the testimony we had, there are regulations that spell out the relationship between the midwife and the
physician who is in charge of the case.
And it seems like a very appropriate and good bill. If there are questions, I'd be happy to respond to those.
Senator Eliza.
Chairman, I just have a general question. I see that evidently the Health, Education, and Social Services Committee signed off on the bill. When it comes into finance, and the finance puts out a committee substitute, what's the difference? What did you catch that they didn't get?
The question that had not been brought to them, and we have correspondence on that, Mike Thomas had been out of town. He represents the American Council of, well, he had appeared at that meeting and said that he would give information to the Finance Committee because he did not have the position and that particular thing worked out. So that was a new issue that was brought to us. And as I say, it's merely talks to the phase-in and these Brian Rogers really supported or is supporting this bill on the House side. And there's no problem with the changes that are being suggested.
Chairman? So I was wondering what's the bill doing in committee?
Well, there's no additional cost. It allows for, under the insurance laws, for private insurance companies to be able to pay, will now be required to pay for this. And it also makes it an allowable category under Medicaid. So there's no additional fiscal. Mr. Chairman, may I move the bill?
I have a question. We have a nurse's representative here, you said?
Yes, we do. Barbara Walker. Barbara, could you come up, please?
Mr. Chairman, I have a question which is related to nurses, but not necessarily midwives. I received a call and met with some representatives from a couple of the villages, and they indicated that the nurses had changed either the regulations or were going to change, attempt to change the law on whether or not nurses could, public health nurses could go out and take care of acute cases as they came up, emergency cases and things of this sort. Has that been changed?
No, sir.
Was that a recommendation that came from the Nurses Association?
No, sir, not to my knowledge. They may be thinking of perhaps some changes in the Department of Health and Social Services in regards to public health nurses working in remote areas, but there is a bill introduced, Senate Bill 238, which is a complete revision of the Nurse Practice Act.
But okay, that must be it then.
It's primarily an updating of existing law, but there's nothing in those proposed changes that would prohibit, you know, nurses assisting. I think the Good Samaritan law in the state of Alaska allows for nurses and physicians and anyone in that situation to offer assistance and aid in an emergency. And there, to my knowledge, there are no regulations promoted to prohibit that.
Okay. I'll find out more about it when we get to that bill.
One question, if I might, Senator Sturgis. If this becomes law, then basically nurse midwives can set up their own billing procedures and their own practice, per se, as far as...
Barbara, could you respond to that, please?
I think, sir, primarily it just would allow the insurance company to reimburse the nurse midwife directly rather than, as currently is done, the physician is the only person reimbursed.
But this is what I'm saying. This would allow then the nurse midwife to set up her own practice, do her own billing, and receive her own monies from the insurance
company. Yes, sir.
Basically, what we're doing is permitting this particular level of skill to practice medicine unrelated, uncontrolled.
No, sir. The nurse midwife, by law, cannot practice without an established collaborative relationship with a physician. The boards of nursing and medicine in January of last year adopted, finally, after about a six-year struggle, regulations governing the practice of all advanced nurse practitioners, and nurse midwives are one category under advanced nurse practitioners. And the regulation specifically says that the advanced nurse practitioner or the midwife shall submit to the board documented evidence of an established collaborative relationship with the physician actively licensed in the state or specifically exempted by law, whose usual scope of practice includes the same practice area of the applicant. But nurse midwives always work in collaboration with a physician in all states. the only so-called midwives who work on their own are the so-called lay midwives, who are usually people with no medical education who work in the community and assist women with home deliveries. But nurse midwives usually do their deliveries in the hospital, and they follow women who are pregnant through pre-pregnant through the pregnancy state until such time that the person delivers, or if there's a medical complication, then the physician is called in to collaborate.
Mr. Chairman, just as a little additional information, you have a memorandum to me from the maternal child health coordinator, and on the third page of that, it talks about just a synopsis of the regulations, but very definitely, I think that's been part of the problem, the lay midwife and then the nurse midwife, but we do have regulations that cover that. There has to be an approved relationship between the doctor. It covers the scope of practice, consultation, communication, referral, assessment. So it's very clearly laid out as to who is responsible. The doctor is accountable. He's the one that really is in charge and has to take the ultimate responsibility for what happens. Is that correct?
Yes, ma'am, except that, well, the nurse midwife is responsible for, ultimately, too, for her, you know, for her practice. But there does have to be a collaborative relationship. In other words, a nurse midwife just can't go out under Alaska law and start working as a nurse midwife without having a collaborative relationship with a physician.
Well, Senator Simpson.
Mr. Chairman, I'm having trouble understanding what the practical aspects of that collaborative relationship would be. Could you explain how that would really work? I mean, would a nurse midwife actually be in contact frequently with the physician, or does it just mean there's a physician available if a problem should develop, or...
Well, usually the physician and nurse would work out between themselves at what point would the nurse midwife consult the physician. And they would come to some agreement and perhaps discuss and know what was a normal pregnancy to them. And if at any point, then the physician might say, well, you know, if you observe 1, 2, 3, 4 symptoms, be sure you always let me know so that I can check. And, of course, the nurse midwife, any deviation from a so-called normal pregnancy, the nurse midwife would always consult the physician because there might be a complication. That's part of her education and training.
So if I could continue, Mr. Chairman, the physician... In most cases, would never even see the mother then. It would always be the nurse midwife unless a problem developed.
Probably, unless the physician, if she has a collaborative relationship with the physician, usually that physician has staff privileges at the hospital where the nurse midwife might be delivering the babies. And so in that instance, I would assume that the physician might just routinely see those patients if they were in the hospital and he were there with other patients anyway.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Chairman, I'd like to move the bill. Individual recommendation.
Objection.
Pick up 17 then.
Next bill we'll take after Senate Bill 17. Senator Banquet.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate Bill 17 amends the Executive Budget Act by removing certain references to terminology acquainted with budgeting by program category. It makes it clear that the future budgeting is to be on an agency basis. Budgeting by program was recommended in the early 70s as a method to reveal the full cost and achievement of program objectives within an agency. Since then, I think this method is proven not to fulfill those objectives. And it lacks the obvious accountability of the department heads that we would have under direct agency budgeting. Because of the number of people that I'd like to testify, not necessarily in sequence, I would like to have asked some of the previous finance chairmen who had a great deal of experience working with the program budgeting to give us their comments this morning. And because of a very tight schedule, I would like to ask the Vice Chairman of the House Finance Committee, Representative Orr Freeman, if we could take him just a little out of sequence and ask him to come forward and give us his opinion of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I'm delighted to have the opportunity to say a kind word for the proposal that you're considering. For a number of years, I have felt that if I just kept working harder at it, I would understand better and better how the program budgeting was supposed to work. And after 6 years, I've just about given up hope. I would have talked about and thought about in the past introducing a bill to do what you have done or doing here, but I've always had the feeling that maybe the time wasn't right, because the proper time would be the time when both finance committees of both the House and the Senate decided maybe something should be done about it. And I believe this is the time. Because I believe that, I have taken the liberty of talking to the finance chairman of the House and trying to sell him on the idea, and with his approval, we had an exact duplicate of the bill that you had before you prepared and introduced by the House Finance Committee. And we have, and I've talked to a great number of the members on the committee that are very supportive, and I think that this is a proper time. And, for several years, I've been and had the subcommittee on transportation, and it's almost impossible for me to really run down through the different categories of the budget and fish out and hunt out and try to determine exactly what I'm doing there, what the department is doing. And to be real honest with you, I've never really been able to convince myself that I know exactly what's going on. And that bothers me. I came in years ago into state government from municipal government, and at that time we had agency budgeting. And when you picked up a budget that dealt with a certain department, you could go through it line by line, determine who did what and how much it cost and whether or not you were getting your money's worth, and make a determination. I'm not able to do that with the method of the program budgeting. And those members that I see around here that have had lots of experience probably have suffered some of the same frustrations that I have, and they can speak for themselves. But with that, Mr. Chairman, I just want to say that I recommend wholeheartedly the support of the bill that you have before you.
Thank you, Reverend. Any questions?
Thank you very much.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman. Oral, in terms of the practical aspects of this, I would assume what we would see is that the agencies would essentially prepare the budgets as they do now, and also then prepare a new budget that would comply with an agency budget. And I'm just wondering how you see the practical aspects of that really working.
Well, the practical aspects of it, of course, as far as I'm concerned, to be real simple about it, I want... If it deals, for instance, with Department of Transportation, when I pick up a Department of Transportation budget, I want to find everything that they have involved. Just to give you an example, in the transportation budget that I am handling, okay, they have 2,255 positions in there. When I go over and look in general government, when I start fishing around, I go over in general government, I find another 548 positions in general government. But I'm supposed to be working with a transportation budget. And as far as I'm concerned, any budgeting process that you try to look at one at a time that has parts and components scattered all over all the budgets, I just don't think you can do it properly that way. I just don't have the time. Maybe it's because I don't have the smarts. And I've always assumed that that might be the case, but I watch my colleagues that I know that are a lot smarter than I am having the same problem, so there must be something wrong with the system rather than being wrong with me.
Mr. Chairman, one further question on that. If this legislation should pass, our effective date on it is July 1st, 1981. What kinds of... do we need to be concerned about making the change halfway through a legislative session and ending up with totally different budget documents next time around, or do you think that would even make things better?
Senator, from the practical aspect, I can't say for sure, but I believe that it can be done. And even if they only got two-thirds of it done, it couldn't be any worse, in my estimation, it couldn't be any worse than we have now. So I think that almost any step that we make in that direction, even if we don't get it completed in one period, I think is an improvement. And I'm not afraid of the consequences of it myself as a Finance Committee member.
Dr. Zelinski.
Through the chair, Representative Freeman, obviously the planning and programming part of transportation being somewhere else sure doesn't give you the whole picture, but if this were to go, I'd sure like to see it work. Do you see that the budget format itself, let's assume that we pull planning and programming back, which is the major sector that's out of the transportation budget you and I are looking at, would that satisfy your concerns, or is it deeper than that in the way information is presented? I'm trying to see, is it just simply that let's get the agency totally under one budget? Is that the problem?
I believe that if we could get it all in one stack so we could examine it and really find out who's doing what, who's supposed to be doing what, and mostly what they're not doing that they should be doing that I don't know about, almost anything that we do in that direction I think would be an improvement. And I pick on Department of Transportation, their transportation category of the budget, because it's one that I'm more familiar with. But when I start, I can't get an overall picture of what these people are really doing and what it's costing and whether we're getting their money's worth. And that's the part that bothers me.
Thank you. Senator
Ferguson. Well, you would say a duplication of service with program budgeting and possibly double dipping.
Senator, that's the one thing that bothers me more than anything else. I feel that it's there. I know it's there, and sometimes, most of the time, I can't find it because I simply don't have the time and the knowledge and the expertise. And we have, as you well know, in our fiscal analyst, the legislative fiscal analyst, we have some very, very competent people. And if they sit here and work on the thing year in and year out and they can't find all of it, I don't have a chance.
Thank you, Senator, and I appreciate the opportunity to hear. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, we have with us two, and I think probably it would be proper to go that way. One of the most experienced, budget as far as legislation is concerned here, and Senator Sackett, and I'd like to have him comment on the bill as he's doing.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When I first came down here in 66, 67, we were on a departmental budget at that point in time. In addition to that, making it easier, I think there was also the thing that we've just gone over $100 million in the total budget, too. So things were a little easier. Then we did change to program budgeting. I think it took me between 6 and 8 years before I felt personally confident that I understood to a great extent where everything was within the different categories. And I can remember making tremendous mistakes on assuming that I knew where various departments were organized, and then finding, that there were large gaps just because I hadn't looked through all of the different categories to find out where they had put various parts of their departments. Senator Stimson indicated that he felt that with the addition of this bill that there would be, I think you indicated it might be another layer or another hoop that we would have to, the departments have to go through. And I don't see it that way. I think there would be probably one less, or probably many less layers of steps that the departments would have to take. What is occurring now, I think, is that you have a program budgeting, and then they're getting different concepts of budgeting on top of that. Such as last year, which was the introduction of by the Department of Natural Resources of going back to management by objectives, or their form of management by objectives. And all of this to the legislator who comes down here just for a short period of time is extremely difficult to comprehend and gets cumbersome. And I think what occurs is what Representative Freeman brought up, is that eventually there's runaway budgeting and you have absolutely no control over anything. The last point I want to make is that after we go through all these categories and look at the various programs, what in reality does occur is that the budget does go back to that specific department. And they run those programs out of that department. We never really have the opportunity to see that department as it functions as one entity, even though in reality that's what it does. And for all of the problems that it creates, I don't think that the value of program budgeting is there or existing. I think probably conceptually it's a good idea, but it does create too many problems, particularly for the legislature coming down here on a part-time basis and not really working on it totally all the time.
Thank you, Senator Sanchez. Any questions?
Mr. Chairman, not in response to John's, but one thing I hope we can get, because I agree and I disagree, in that I'm afraid if we go strictly to agency, and I suspect this whole thing gets into what the computer can produce for us, and I suppose it can do the other, but I think that a lot of these things are spread across, and maybe we're failing in the way we're approaching it, but the need is still there. For instance, with bottom fish, I've just been talking to Senator Stimson, where one agency listed as a capital program, I think that's all in error, but they don't show the positions, but a part of that is being carried out through CRA, and they're actually listing the positions. So you get these agencies where it really cuts across a number of departments and divisions, and you might have pretty darn good accountability of the agency, but you've got a number of different agencies, and the same person's not going to be on the other ones. And I'm wondering if there's a method of being able to, you know, respond. Perhaps we could have some kind of review and information on a total program basis where it cuts across these lines and still get the advantages of the agency report. Because I really agree with what Senator Sackett thinks. You just suddenly decide, you know, there's 500 people out there you haven't talked to. So I'd like some comment on whether we could have an agency budget, but also have a way that we can review total programs, because I think there's a lot of problems there.
Even within the existing categories that you have, in order for an agency to come up with a particular budget with the dollar figures and the personnel stuff like that, they do have the goals and objectives and the program laid out in there. And what I think what we're talking about here is just taking all of what exists in the budget and reshuffling it back to that specific department. And there's no change, I think. You still see the program, you still see their goals, you still see their objectives, you still see their management techniques, you still see exactly what areas they have responsibility will be under their goals and objectives, even within a departmental category, budget.
To make the point again, let's take agriculture, for instance. If you've got that under the university budget, a part of it, the extension, you've got it under DNR, you've got it under Office of the Governor, I don't know, that may be one. I think energy you might get five. But under this proposed way, you just get the agency's responsibility and everything could be going up. I mean, you could have duplicative administrative charges, let's say, in three different categories. You wouldn't catch that. You'd just catch the agency under this proposal. Is that not correct?
Right. You would catch the agency and then you would, I think, just through the experience, find out that the Division of University of Alaska Extension, for example, does have an agricultural program under the University of Alaska budget. And I would assume that, you know, the administration is supposed to administer, and one of their things is to make sure that there's no duplication in administration, too. One assumes.
Senator Dick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Along with asking former finance chairman and their experience, we've heard from Representative Freeman and Senator Sackett. I'd ask one of the more experienced members of the legislature, it's been around a long time, to, if he would come and comment on going back to agency budgeting. He was here before it was program budgeting, and he went through the program budgeting. And we'd like your comments, if you would, Senator Brown.
I've been in the legislature, I guess, 17 years now, and I think I've been on finance committees 14 of those 17 years. I've been the chairman of both the House and the Senate Finance Committees. I've worked with both the agency budgets and the program budgets. And I feel that if you want to get the, you want to be able to trace the full monies and who's doing what, then you have to go back to your agency budgeting. It's extremely difficult in program budgeting to actually define exactly what the agencies are doing. I don't know what Senator Sackett's experience has been or what he's testified, but the last 2 years that I was on the finance, which was the previous 2 years, I again had difficulty in tracing and finding where the money was being expended and by who and for what reason. You have so many interfacing requests from the different departments that you have a duplication of effort a lot of times, and you have a duplication of expenses. And it's the old game of they hide the money and we try to find it. And I think with agency budget, we'll have a lot better chance. We'll have at least a 50-50 opportunity.
Questions?
Thank you, Mr.
Chairman. I think the what sequence we should call the next witness. Listen to the administration or continue on. Perhaps this would be a good time, since we've listened to the former finance chairman, to come back and. Because I'm going to ask the director of finance, Hogan, to testify a little later, and his testimony will be a little more detailed and gets into the amendments for this bill. I think I'll ask that the administration, Mr. Ron Lear of Budget Management, if he would come and give the administration's opinion. I wouldn't be favorable.
Mr. Chairman, I've already talked with Senator Danquist somewhat about this, but I'm going to recommend against the bill. And if I could also offer an option, if you will. And my recommendations against it are not because it would be easier for us to do what we're doing versus doing under the agency budget. In fact, if anything, it would be easier for us under the agency budgeting because we could deal also, as you do, with one agency at a time. But the reason I would recommend against it is because I think of the focus or the change in focus. Right now, with program budgeting, you're focusing on the services that are being delivered to the public. I think if you went to agency budgeting, you'd get a much more introspective thing where you would get a focus by each commissioner on what is most administratively convenient for them as opposed to what would be the best services to produce. And let me give an example of the aging program. In our aging program, we have all the best we can, the services provided to the aged. We have three departments involved: community, regional affairs, health and social services, and department of administration. And when you look at the aging budget, like I say, you have most of the services to the aged combined there, and you're looking at trade-offs, if you will, between things such as Pioneers Homes and the Homemaker Services. For instance, if you put more funds in the Homemaker Services, you may be able to keep more people in their home and not in institutions such as the Pioneers Homes. You can look at those kind of options. But if you go to an agency budgeting, you're going to be looking at trade-offs between the Pioneers Homes and the Division of Finance. And, I don't see where those are very different types of trade-offs. And, we work both with the program, and we also work with agencies. I mean, when we start doing rebuttals when they don't like numbers. And they will focus on what's administratively convenient for them, because that's just a natural thing. They focus more upon inside state government than on services to the public. And I think that the more you go to agency budgeting, the more you're going to get that kind of a situation. Now, as far as the idea of seeing a lot of the testimony has been, well, we want to see what all they're doing. Well, it strikes me that if you want to see what all state government as an entity is doing with respect to any particular group, you have it with program budgeting. If you go to the agency budgeting, you might be able to see all the activities that any one department's involved in, but it seems to me that what we do within state government in itself isn't anywhere near as important as the services that are provided by state government. And as far as like the duplication, going back to my aging example, if you have administration, as a department and as a separate budget handled by, say, one subcommittee, what's the chances that they're going to talk to whoever has health and social services or versus community and regional affairs to see if you have all that kind of duplication? I mean, it's possible, clearly. But I don't think, as a practical matter, that's going to happen as much as it will under the present system. Anyway, so like I said, I think that you get a real change in focus. You get a focus to going back inside state government as opposed to outside services delivered. I have talked with some of the senators before this on the problems that just the budget as a whole presents to you. And I guess that's probably your copy of the budget over there. I don't know how many volumes. I think we once counted 25,000 pages is what the detailed budget is, which no one's going to read. And I wonder if part of the idea of going back to what's called agency budgeting is to try to give you a more manageable document. Because if all a person is going to fund them with is what we call the detailed budget, it's just too much. I mean, it's not only too much for you when you're down here for a few months, it's too much for us almost on a full year basis. And the I have mentioned this to some of you before, but the thing that we use on the governor's side and we put together is what we call a policy budget. And you can call it a preliminary budget. It really doesn't matter. But it's definitely a program budget, but it doesn't contain all the detailed information. We split all the 9 or 10, if you will, categories into what we call 42 programs, something like that. So we look at these things on a program basis, aging being a program. Sometimes the programs correspond with the department. The fisheries program is strictly fish and game. But what happens, you have then a manageable number of things to have to work with. You concentrate, again, on the services being delivered, but you have all of them put together in one place. We got some very interesting discussions, like when we talked on some of the economic development or the energy development ones. You have two or three agencies involved, and you know you start seeing some cases where they're probably not working very well together because Agency A doesn't know what Agency B is doing. And only the budget forced them to act, you have to get together and talk with each other. And if they don't even have the budget forcing them to do that, they're not going to do it. I mean, unless, you know, someone tries to impose that on them, but the budget is a good vehicle for pointing out those kind of difficulties. Senator Sturgeluski mentioned the bottom fish budget. By having a bottom fish budget together as a program, you can see what the administration is proposing to spend in bottom fish statewide. If we split the bottom fish budget up, you're never going to see a good chunk of it, because a lot of it isn't all that big. I mean, maybe you have $100,000 for fish and game. It's just going to be buried in a $25 million budget. And, you know, the way we present this information, it's to try to present it in the way that would be the most useful to the legislature to see what services we're recommending be produced and at what cost. If we do it the other way, it's you know, we're going to be providing you less information than we do right now.
Ron, let's just take let me make one comment that I think it's supposed to work that way. That was the design. The fact is, after about 7 years, every finance chairman that I've brought here today that's had to work with it says it's not working. It's not doing those things which you say it's doing. And that's the same thing. I was here as a director in that the day we started this. And it hasn't worked in, and I helped put it together. It makes good rhetoric, but it doesn't work when you take a bunch of laymen to come down here for 60 or 90 days to handle several billion dollar budget. Those are all, they sound better. Let's take your bottom fish for a minute. All in one category. I know in my discussion with the subcommittee chairman, Senator Stimson, we see where there's money in the capital budget, which is funneled through economic development, which is handed out to fish and game to hire people all under the guise of bottom fish study. Now, how do you trace all that around? And it's just because he's very astute, he grabs this and runs it around from the capital budget over to here, and he finds out you guys are taking money there and moving it over to fish and game. They're hiring permanent employees that don't show up. That's what I was talking about I won't dwell on it, but I don't think, well, I guess what I'm trying to say is that these volumes of books and stuff, it brings to that point where, like Senator Sackett says, we need to go back to be able to grasp the departments, and it's nice to talk about services as a whole, and I still think that we can do that. It's going to take some study, and whoever's on finance is going to have to, as Senator Sackett says, acquaint themselves with what departments are handling what. But that in itself isn't too difficult. You can hand a person a sheet and tell them what departments handle for bottom fish, follow it through. But at any rate, we don't want to be argumentative about it. I'll just hush.
Mr. Chairman, on the question that Senator Dankworth raises, which I think kind of gets to the heart of this, it seems to me a statement and then a question. If we go on the basis of we know what fish and game is doing with bottom fish, but that's the budget I have, so I don't know what Commerce is doing, and I don't know what CRA is doing. Seems to me the big problem gets into more how the information is presented to the legislature. A couple questions. How many programs do we have that cut across agency lines? Are there a huge number of them, or are they relatively easily identified? 15, 20?
It's somewhere around 15 to 20. We've counted them before.
That would impact different agencies. I mean, we have this agency, and I'm going to take fish and game, so I'll never see transportation, and it may affect this program, may affect those two.
Okay, there, it seems like there's an important thing that the administration has to do to keep a control on this. It's also important to the legislature. But how can we present
the whole mass of information in a way that we can, number one, get that agency accountability, and also, through assignment or something, get the program review? It seems like both are important elements, and we would lose a very important one if we went to the agency. And, gosh, you got all the information, it seems like.
Mr. Chairman, the present system you have right now will give you the second that you asked for, the program information. Back to the accountability of an individual department. When you go to the actual detailed budget, each one of those budget request units is by department. And so you have, on a very fine level, what they say they're going to produce, assuming they have decent measures there, and what it's going to cost. So you have that accountability at the lowest level, I mean, even below a commissioner level, if you will.
Mr. Chairman, why can't you provide for us? Your programs are made up of components, pieces of the budget. Why can't it be presented in an agency format, also with the program information, in two methods, simply by using your computers? I don't understand why you can't. You take it apart to look at the program, put it together for the agency, but still have the program. I don't understand why that can't be done.
Well, of course, we're talking about those budgets right there. I mean, you can do it just mechanically. We could prepare the governor's budget, say, for instance, exactly the way we do it right now on a program basis.
That's right.
And then we could submit it to you by taking our books and taking them apart. And instead of having a book that says education category, we'd put Department of Education, we'd take some of the other chunks. Sure.
Ways. You know, I don't know all that goes into that. And you know, is everybody working every day with all those? It's the pulling it together so you can look at it from both ways that it seems to me a value. It might mean a different set of books.
Well, I mean, we can give you the books in however you want them, and we can give you duplicates, if you will. I mean, if you want to have the one set of books by agency and one set by program, you may have to get some more bookshelves. But we can provide them.
I think what we're really talking about is an ability to have that in a form you can handle. Is that possible without going through, you know, another set of books? Can't that be pulled together?
Well, I mean, we can give you the financial information, the numerical stuff, and we do. In both agency and category format. I mean, but that, I'm assuming you want to look at it beyond that part. I mean, if you get down to the narrative information, it's just a matter of formatting in a different fashion. I think that as long as you're working with something as immense as a detailed budget, however we present the information is going to be overwhelming. I mean, there's just so much of it. There's no way to get around that. If I could make copies of some of the policy budgets available to people to let you see what we work with and at what level, and it's a lot easier to look at that. You're not reading 25,000 words of pages of stuff. You're reading maybe a stack like yay from the table. It you lose some of the detail. You don't have all the immense amount of detail about, you know, who traveled here and who bought a new desk, but you have a lot more concentration on what they say they can produce with that amount of money.
We don't want to dwell on this. I know I've been there, and I made those budgets out, and I know how I tell them what I'm going to do if I got a new trooper at hand, and then I try to predict 3 years ahead what all he's going to do and what all we're going to do if we can have a trooper at Healy. And I spend, and I have to have a full-time position to write all that up and present it to you who never reads it, so it'll go in a big book that nobody ever really looks at. And that's the thing that the program, I think it'd just be... I'd just like to rather have the Commissioner of Public Safety over here and ask him, what are you going to do with that trooper if you're asking for a new position? And you can do the same thing. I don't have any objections to your department going ahead with your programming. If you'd like to do that and get your program. But for the purpose of 60 people who come here to do this budget, the agency makes it a lot easier. Is there any other questions?
Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to... follow up on some of the frustrations that I think a lot of us are experiencing, and the bottom fish has been mentioned a couple times. What we have is, and I'm sure you're very familiar with it, bottom fish budget, which includes the Department of Fish and Game, the Department of Community and Regional Affairs, Department of Education, Department of Commerce and Economic Development, Department of Labor. And all of that is operating budget, and it's coming through the capital budget. And we've requested of the agency to bring that up in the operating budget. And essentially the response that I'm getting is they're not going to do it.
And I want to tell you, I see some real problems brewing, and it's awfully difficult for us to... And you want to know the rationale that I was given? Was that the governor has a ceiling on the operating budget. They can't put these in the operating budget. You know, it's just an indication to me of the problems that we have with this budgeting process. You know, I try not to think that this is a devious approach to get some stuff into the operating budget, but what's happening is we've got about $6 million, about $2 million of it's legitimate capital, and the rest is operating, and you know full well all that's going to surface in our budgets next year in the operating budgets. And there's a good possibility we may not even have known this was going to happen. And anyway, I just, to me, it's just symptomatic of some of the frustrations that we're having with the budgeting process right now.
Can I just respond to the bottom fish one? That's causing a lot of problems. The remo that you saw probably that referred to the cost was basically a result of, because when they were going to put their budget together this year, we'd done it before in the capital budgets. And I told them that it's an operating budget, put it together in the operating budget. So we got this memo back from them that said, no, we want to have it for all these reasons. Well, finally, the decision, I'd say, by the Budget Review Committee was to go ahead and put it in capital, not for their reason, but, again, because it was easier to collect the things. There's no question but what those are operating budget items. The bulk of them are, which is why my original directive, if you will, to them was to put it in the operating budget. So I'm not going to try to defend those things as capital budget items. They're not. They're clearly operating budget items. The capital budget was, again, used as a way to collect them. But, yeah, they should eventually definitely be rolled in the operating budget because that's what they are.
Mr. Chairman, I submit this is the reason why going to an agency budget, one of the negatives to it, that you wouldn't even know that the problem you just brought up exists. You've got six agencies there, and you would be dealing, let's say, with education or one of those others, unless, you know, you're going to do all the budgets and we change the way we approach it. You wouldn't know you had a problem. At least now you've got a problem, you know, and you can get a solution to it.
Except those are an exception to the rule by a great, great, great percentage. You know, there are those situations, and there are those situations that should not exist necessarily. There shouldn't be five departments working on the same objective. That in itself is inefficiency. And you know, there are those cases that exist where it's like that. Many cases they shouldn't, but by far 98% of the budget itself
have their functions of responsibility and services by department.
Mr. Chairman, to Senator Sackett, if we have, say, some major programs, maybe 10 or 15 that fit somewhat into this category in varying degrees of difficulty, I wonder if there's a way that we could go to the agency to get the benefits of that, but also have some kind of a report made, and I don't know how it would be, on the basis that you could look and you could assign those so that you'd get the benefit. Because I really worry about this ability to control some of those programs, because I think it can just get out. That's my only hang-up on this, is how do we get, in a sense, both ways, but perhaps not the detail under, say, under the program. It would still allow the administration to go through the program budget thing, but they present it to us as agency, because they're really just dealing with components. They could do their review. If we could get some kind of a report that would cut across those lines so they'd be subject to review, I think we can get into some... That probably was one of the persuasions, now I wasn't there, of course, and some of you were, that led to the program budget in the first place, was to get a handle on some of those programs that were expanding. I don't know if that's true or not, Senator Sackett.
I think when it was proposed, in fact, I know when it was proposed, that there was a new concept in financial management accounting procedures that were going nationwide. That, and particularly at that point in the state's development, when we were looking at expanding services to residents, and we wanted to come up with this new concept, and at the same time there was the demand for services, and you could see laid out before you all of these services being provided. I think we've come to the point where we have enough services, and people are tired of services and want to cut back on government, just want to go to departments.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I'd like to call as the next witness, Mr. Hogan. I think probably Jay can give us some background, particularly as to how we got into program budgeting and what portion of it we didn't follow through on, and have a little background. Will, Jay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jay Hogan, Director of Legislative Finance. If I could call to the committee's attention, there is a little selection in your bill file that is the executive summary from the series of reports that were prepared to implement program budgeting in 1971 and 72. Briefly, the history of program budgeting was that it passed as an act in 1970. It was a piece of model legislation introduced by the then governor, and the implementation of program budgeting fell to next administration. It was a sort of situation like that. The Management Analysis Center, Inc., was the firm selected by the administration, Department of Administration, in 1971 to prepare the format, if you will, for beginning program budgeting. And the advantages of the program budgeting concept are outlined in the white pages that are the beginning of the report. Now, the final report, which has a few pages reproduced in pink, and unfortunately there's another report beyond this, and I have been unable to come up with a copy of it. But the concept was designed around the eventual reorganization of state government so that state government would become organized along the program category lines. And what happened was that we never went that last step. The very last enclosure is a bill, House Bill 676, that was introduced in 1972 by the then total membership of the House Finance Committee that would have accomplished this reorganization. That bill never passed. But the concept as presented by the consultants envisioned reorganization of state government along program category lines. And the reason for it was that they felt this, they anticipated this desire, I guess, of the legislature and others, that people responsible for the programs should be identifiable and they should have control over the programs within the entire program category. So that what you have now is a situation where we have program budgeting superimposed upon an organizational structure. In some cases, it's not a bad arrangement because you have most of the department's functions. In other programs, certain departments virtually lose their identity. They are so scattered. And as to one question, Mr. Chairman, that Director of Budget Management referred to, the whole budget in its abbreviated format is on the computer, and it really isn't a difficult matter to sort it one way as opposed to another. In other words, if the BRC feels more comfortable reviewing the budget by program, the computer can sort it out by program. If the legislature feels more comfortable about reviewing the budget by agency, then the legislature can sort it out by agency. It is really not that difficult a task. So basically, that's the history of it. And, or the theoretical history and the actual history.
Mr. Chairman? Oh, excuse me, go ahead.
Well, if I may, I won't get lengthy, Senator Sturdy-Luskin, and I'll get back to you. Thank you. But I noticed on the, and I wanted to call attention that one of our members,
yes,
was on that original bill, Ferguson, that was there when we put Senator Sturdy-Luskin.
Oh, Chair. Mr. Hogan. You said the information's all there. Now, I'm trying to get down again to that basic concern. I understand we did not go through to the final step, which would have made it a lot more logical. However, I still think there's a tremendous value in looking at programs, because if you control it over here and you don't over here, you're kidding yourself. Just because it's simple doesn't mean it's any bloody good. Now, is there a way, if it's done on the program level by the administration, and they do all the stuff they present to us now, is there still a way that it can be done in the agency format, but also the program component delivered so that there could perhaps be an assignment to various subcommittees of the finance so that they could review it? I think to lose
Are you saying we should just drop any program evaluation and not consider it? I think maybe we're semantics as to
what we're looking at here. What is your, if we were to go to the agency budget, and that's what the bill says, what would you see the Finance Committee's role in reviewing programs? How would they do it, and what would you see their responsibility, and is it important?
Mr. Chairman, I think in many cases some of the programs would be properly combined under the agency. Perhaps there's two ways to approach it. We could have cross-references in the budget to identify those programs that cover more than one agency. That wouldn't be that difficult. I think Ron mentioned that there might be 15 or 20 such programs. They could be cross-referenced, and we could get a programmatic presentation of those key areas. That's one way to do it. Another way to do it would be to, as I said, the computer can sort the documents either way rather rapidly. We could have, from our side, the little short-form books could be printed up in agency order as well as program order for those who wanted to check out some program combinations. It isn't a great problem to run it either way.
Mr. Chairman?
The legislature might prefer to work from one as opposed to the other, but they could have access to both.
To Mr. Hogan, are we talking about merely how we present information to the legislature and to the finance committees as opposed to how we prepare and the analysis we go through?
Would you go back to this kind of simple, you know, what is your view? What information should the legislature have in order to control
budget growth and all the rest? Should we just have an agency budget expanded back to what we had pre-70? Should we have program information that is separately? What would you have the administration do in preparing their analysis that comes to us?
Mr. Chairman, the over the years that I've worked with the legislature seems to prefer to hold an administrative officer accountable for a program. There is a more comfortable feeling about that as far as the legislature is concerned. As a person who works with budgets, to me it's not as important an issue because I have more time to spend ferreting out the problems. But a legislator does not have that time, and it's been my experience that they tend to prefer dealing with the people who can actually control the totality of the programs that they're presented with. In the analysis of it, as far as we're concerned, it doesn't matter. In the execution, as far as the agency is concerned, it does operate on an agency level. When the appropriations are made, some of the advantages of program budgeting do not, in fact, materialize because the agencies are in charge of the expenditure of things that are legally placed in their hands.
Mr. Chairman?
And they don't have the flexibility, for instance, to move the funds.
Mr. Hogan, what you just said to us was, we will get, then, part of this, and since you have professional staff, you can still pull it out and get it, look at these things. But we're giving a great deal, then, of, you know, we have to be dependent upon your coming and say, hey, we think here's a problem, and you're probably staff your people according to agency. Does that mean you have to add another level to look at the development budget? You know, I think that's information this body should have, and I just think it's a question of more forms than, you know, I think we're in a great deal of semantics here.
Sure, let's make it simple, but not if we lose a whole ability to, you know, look at the program aspects of it. It seems like you'd do it both, couldn't you? Couldn't you present it in a matter of form so that we would have both those approaches?
Mr. Chairman, yes, that's relatively easy to do.
Further questions?
Just a general question. Jay, how many, do you have statistics on how many states have adopted this particular method?
No, Mr. Chairman, I don't, really.
What procedures, of course, the federal example, government's not a good example, what procedures they use?
The federal government? Mr. Chairman, the federal government's budgeting practice is so, in my mind, so bizarre, it's not worth considering. They solve their problem by adding another level of committees to it. They have agency budgets, but the congressional budget review practice is so strange. They have authorizations, they have appropriations, they now have budget committees over both those. It's a very unusual. No, to my knowledge, no other state has a system like the federal government.
Would you say,
if I might, just for a moment. Senator Barrington, the hour is getting so late. We got started about 10 minutes late. We'll have to reschedule your bill for tomorrow morning.
One further question, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, if we were to go back to agency budget, then and we red tag the ones that cross agencies and divisions, would that give us an easier, would we have easier for us to understand the budget as a whole than what we're doing now?
Mr. Chairman, I think the work of reviewing the budgets would still remain the same. Presumably the committees would assign agencies with some sense of balance. The larger agencies would be assigned to one person, and some of the smaller agencies would be grouped together. So I would think the work would be the same. Under the concept of identifying programs that are special area programs like the bottom fish one, I think they'd stand out just as well, because they are... There's a project that was identified as a possible problem area by our staff people. I think the same thing could apply under the agency setup.
I'd move that we move Senate Bill Number 17 out with individual recommendations.
Mr. Chairman, if I could ask Senator Ferguson to hold his motion, I would like just for the purpose of discussion. There's a proposed amendment. We're talking about in terms of
are there the supplemental appropriation and budget amendments?
Yes.
Like?
No.
Yes. I don't rather in the time left here. Do we have enough time to discuss that amendment? What's your opinion, Senator Sack? Is that going to require a lot of discussion?
Yeah.
Probably. When is the finance meeting? I won't be here next week. Let me make this suggestion that because of the time element, I really want that amendment, and I want to have time to discuss it. And one other, I'd like to move that we hold this bill over until Tuesday's meeting. We'll have time to discuss it some more. You don't mind, do you, Frank?
No.
Does any member have anything they wish to bring before the committee at this time?
We have tomorrow.
Senator Ferguson.